Chief Judge and Judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the court, draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals calls the case of the United States versus Staff Sergeant Charles B. Buford, Jr., miscellaneous docket number 2016-04. Counsel, both sides ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Government counsel, did you wish to reserve any time?
Yes, I asked to reserve 5 minutes, Your Honor.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Chief Judge Mitchell, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Major Mary Ellen Payne, and along with Major Ronnie Steelman, we represent the United States in this case. The military judge abused her discretion in suppressing appellant statement made to the Air Force Office of Special Investigations. Specifically, the military judge made clearly erroneous and unsupported findings of fact and applied the wrong law to those facts. Her ruling should be vacated, and this case returns to trial. Now, in our brief, we identified 8 errors that we believe that the military judge made, but at oral argument today, I would just like to discuss 3 of those errors. The first was her conclusion that the invocation of the right to counsel was unambiguous. The second was the military judge's failure to analyze whether or not appellee initiated further conversation with the agents. And third, the military judge's conclusion that appellee did not knowingly and intelligently waive his right to counsel. So I want to start with the issue of the ambiguous rights invocation, because that is the biggest problem with the military judge's ruling. Because in this case, she simply applied the wrong law. Importantly, this is not a case where the United States merely has a difference of opinion with the military judge. Here, it's a case where she applied the wrong law. Our superior court has stated that a military judge abuses his or her discretion when he or she is incorrect about the application of a law, or I'm sorry, incorrect about the applicable law, or when he or she improperly applies law. That's exactly what we have here. And if she applied the wrong law in this case, there is no discretion to give to her ruling. So specifically, the military judge failed to use an objective standard in evaluating whether or not appellee unambiguously invoked his right to counsel. This is required by the Supreme Court in Davis versus the United States, where the Supreme Court said an accused must articulate his desire to have counsel present sufficiently clear that a reasonable police officer in the circumstances would understand the statement to be a request for an attorney.
Counsel, when you say that the wrong standard was applied, what standard do you believe the judge did apply?
It's unclear. I would say, if anything, she applied a subjective standard, because if we look in paragraph 26 of her ruling, which is really where she addressed the issue of the invocation of rights, she talks about whether appellee understood the circumstances of the case or the consequences of the interview. But what appellee was thinking at that particular time really has no bearing whatsoever on whether or not the agents reasonably thought that he had invoked his right to counsel. So I would say, in answer to your question, Your Honor, it was either a subjective standard or she simply gave her own evaluation of what she thought happened. But I think it's telling that if you look at paragraph 26, and really if you look at the entire ruling, the words reasonable agent are never used in there. So she simply did not apply the correct standard to the case.
Is that required, counsel, that she use the term reasonable agent?
I think it almost is, because how else is this court going to know what standard she applied? I think in most cases where you're reading a ruling where the military judge is applying a standard, they'll use the actual words that have been given to us by either statute or military rules of evidence or by our superior courts. And in this case, the Supreme Court has said that the proper standard to use is what a reasonable officer would have thought.
So, counsel, what facts do you believe would be relevant to what a reasonable investigator would have thought? In other words, based on the record we have before us here, what should the judge have looked to?
Well, one thing, Judge Brown, that the military judge did not look at that she absolutely should have was what happened before the reading of the right to counsel. We had this exchange where essentially the agent says, I'm getting ready to read you your rights. There's this allegation that your IP address has downloaded child pornography, and the agent says, you don't have to talk to me. And appellee's response to that is, no, I'm good to talk. So he says, I'm good to talk. So if we look at what Davis v. United States has said, if we look at our Superior Court's decision in De La Rosa, they all indicate that you can look at the entire context of what happened. You can look at what happened before the rights advisements. You can look at what happened concurrently with the accused making a statement that may be an invocation of rights. And all of these things should be considered. But the military judge did not look at that factor.
Well, counsel, sorry, all three of us are speaking at once. Counsel, let me ask you, she did make findings of fact, though, regarding some of the events that occurred prior to rights advisement in terms of where the appellee was stationed. I know that your brief, you disagree with who drove the appellee from his work location back to the location where he's questioned. So would you agree that she didn't make some limited findings of fact regarding what occurred before rights advisement?
She did make some findings of fact about that, but I think this is an incredibly relevant fact that our Superior Court has looked to this type of issue or this type of fact before in making the decision, and she just ignored that. And it wasn't as if her ruling would be more complete and more defensible, I think, if she had said, well, I took into consideration the fact that appellee said this, but it wasn't essential to my ruling, or even though he may have said this before, I find otherwise. But she didn't even evaluate that fact, and I think that certainly goes to the fact that she committed error in her decision.
Unlike Article 66, which is the normal appellate review standard, where this court can make findings of fact, or in a government appeal under Article 62, where this court is prohibited from making findings of fact. Do you agree?
I agree. You are prohibited from that.
So what would you have this court do then with the trial judges not finding as a fact or not addressing that as a fact what the appellee, I might just call him accused at this point, just to... what the accused said prior to rights advisement, is that clearly erroneous because she didn't make a finding of fact, or would the government have us remand to the trial judge to ask that specific question or other questions?
I don't think that this court has to remand, Your Honor. In our reply brief, the United States cited to Nash v. Estelle. It's a Fifth Circuit case that addressed something like this. What we do have absolutely certain uncontroverted facts or undisputed facts on the record. We have that video that was put into evidence. And what Nash v. Estelle says is that even though a court might normally be bound by a clearly erroneous standard when it comes to facts, if there are these undisputed records, the court can certainly look at them and draw inferences from those facts, draw legal inferences from those facts. And so essentially that is what the government is asking this court to do. There's no reason why this court should not be able to look at a piece of evidence that was entered into the record that the parties have not disputed and draw legal conclusions from that particular piece of evidence.
Now, my understanding of the record, though, is that the parties are disputing in part the transcript of what was said during the interview in other parts that have been addressed. So why are you saying that this earlier portion of the transcript is undisputed? Do we go word by word in terms of what's disputed or undisputed, or is it the entire transcript of the interview that we should regard as being a disputed fact?
I would say only the portions that the parties actually disputed on the record, Your Honor.
Now,
that would be...
Your reply brief, though, in part, answered the defense's argument that you had conceded facts, and you stated that the fact that although the government had not addressed certain facts during your argument in your first motion, that didn't mean you conceded those facts. So why should we now adopt a standard that says both parties concede facts that have not earlier been contested?
Well, I think what we are saying is, what we were saying there is the that particular response addressed the military judge's particular findings of fact. What I'm talking about as far as what the court may consider is facts that were undisputed by either party that are part of the record, and I certainly think that this court can consider them. But if this court feels it cannot consider them, I certainly think rather than affirming the military judge's ruling, the more prudent thing would be to send this back for further evaluation, because the military judge clearly did not consider a lot of very relevant facts in this particular case. But again, I do think even at an Article 62 appeal, this court has the ability to look at the entire record, to look at the undisputed parts of the video, and draw its own legal conclusions from that.
Do we have to determine first, though, that her findings of fact were clearly erroneous before we go look at that other portion of the record, or is it the government's position that just at any time we can go back and look at facts that may have been in the record but not in the ruling that was submitted by the military judge?
The latter, Your Honor. We do believe that it doesn't matter. You don't necessarily have to find the military judge's findings of fact to be clearly erroneous before you can go back. Because what it seems like here is, although we are disputing or we are alleging that some of her findings of fact are clearly erroneous, I think the real issue here is just she ignored some other very, very pertinent facts that she absolutely should have considered in this particular
case. Other than the Fifth Circuit case, so there's no other authority that the government has cited that says we can kind of expand the pool of facts that the judge drew from.
I have not seen other cases. I'm not saying there aren't out there. I have not conducted a very extensive research into what all the other circuits may or may not see in that, but I could certainly follow up with that, Your Honor.
Counsel, I did want to ask you a question about your characterization. The military judge ignored relevant facts. So it's your position that the statement by the accused that I will talk to you prior to rights advisement, that was a critical and relevant fact in determining whether or not the later invocation of rights was ambiguous or unambiguous, correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Did the government make that argument to the judge at trial?
They did not, Your Honor.
Did the government, in their findings or proposed findings of fact that they presented to the military judge, did they include that in their findings of fact?
I don't believe that they did, Your Honor.
And the defense counsel also did not put in that portion of the transcript, correct?
No, I don't believe that they did, Your Honor.
All right, so I guess my question is, if this was so relevant, why it almost seems as though this is Monday morning quarterback to the ninth degree, that this is an argument that the government never made. These are facts and information that the government never presented, and that now for the first time in front of us, you want us to go back and go, oh, the judge abused her discretion by not sua sponte finding some arguments that we now find at the appellate stage. Why should we do that? Why should we address arguments, facts that were not presented or argued before the military judge?
Well, I do believe these facts were there in front of her, Your Honor. There's no doubt about that. It's not as if it was something that we're now trying to supplement the record with. And I think that the military judge does have a duty to look at all of the evidence and look at evidence even if it wasn't necessarily argued by the parties. I mean, it's clear that she did that with respect to the issue of whether or not he was in custody. The military judge said, well, you all didn't argue that, but I find that relevant. So she does do, that is, I think, what we expect military judges to do. And so I don't believe it's dispositive that the government didn't specifically make that argument. If the military judge is talking about, or if the military judge is tasked with looking at all the facts of the case and looking at what's presented to her and making complete findings of fact and accurate conclusions of law, we expect her to consider what everything that is on the record and relevant to that issue.
And the government has the burden as to this motion, correct?
They do, Your Honor.
And so could this court look at the fact that the trial counsel that had the opportunity to interview the agent about what was going on, what his thought processes were, and actually had him testify, that they did not make this argument, Does that not take away from perhaps how relevant this fact is that you're now arguing now? It seems to me if it was really relevant, the trial counsel, those work with the case, work with the agents, they would have made this argument.
Well, I think it's just a case, Your Honor, of different attorneys looking at things differently. So again, I don't believe it's dispositive that perhaps those attorneys at court thought that their stronger argument or a strong enough argument lay in other places or in other parts of the facts. But nonetheless, we assert now that that particular argument is incredibly relevant, and it is something that the military judge should have considered, because the military judge is tasked with considering the totality of the circumstances, whether or not government counsel specifically makes that argument. It was on the record, and it was something that she fairly could have considered and that she should have considered.
And one more question, and we'll see if you got something out of this that perhaps I did not, is the agent actually did testify during the motions hearing. Based on your review of the record, did the agent explain why he believed that the invocation was ambiguous? In other words, the agent could have said, hey, the reason that I thought it was ambiguous was earlier on he said, I want to talk with you, and then later on it really surprised me. Or perhaps he would say, when he invoked the first time and said, sure, is that a yes or no? Sure, yes, that I didn't understand what he meant by yes or no. Did you see anything in his testimony that would explain why a reasonable agent would find that sure, yes, to be an ambiguous request for counsel?
Admittedly, his testimony was not extensive, but I don't think it needed to be, because again, we're talking about a reasonable agent standard. So it doesn't, at the end of the day, matter what Special Agent Rea thought. I mean, conversely, if Agent Rea had said, I did think he was invoking his rights or something to that effect, or that there had been some other context or something else on the record that suggested that Agent Rea indeed did think that Apelli had invoked his right to counsel, then that might have played into the analysis. But it just simply doesn't when we're talking about what a reasonable agent thought. So, I mean, certainly it's not something that is dispositive, and we have to look at the situation of what occurred. And I think when we look at the situation of, when we look at the facts of what occurred, if we look at this rapid fire exchange between the agents and Apelli, the fact that Apelli is asking questions at the very same time he's making what might be considered to be an invocation of the right to counsel, any reasonable agent in that position would be confused. And I think the government's very best argument when we talk about this issue of the ambiguity of the rights invocation is you can't be confident that a suspect is invoking his rights when that suspect is simultaneously asking questions about his right to counsel, and the agents haven't had a chance to even answer those questions. And that's exactly what happened in this case.
All right. Now, I do want you to have some opportunity to get to your other issues in this case, but before we do that, I do want to ask one question. If this court determines that the accused response of sure, yes or no, sure, yes, was an unambiguous invocation of his right to counsel, does the government lose? In other words, in order to get to these other issues, do you have to prevail on whether or not that was an ambiguous invocation of rights?
No, Your Honor, because I believe if those particular statements are held to be unambiguous invocations of the right to counsel, anything that the agent said after that, either that or it was in response to Apelli reinitiating a communication, or what the agent said did not constitute interrogation within the meaning of Rhode Island v. Innis. So either way, even if it was an ambiguous invocation, either Bradshaw or Innis controls, and any follow-up questions that the agents asked were absolutely proper.
If it was an ambiguous invocation of rights, let me back up. If it was an unambiguous invocation of rights, Smith v. Illinois deals with a very similar situation. It was cited in your brief, I think just for a general proposition, where when that individual was asked, do you understand you have a right to counsel, the person says, yes, I think I'd like one. And then the agent or the security forces or investigator in that case then said, hey, one will be provided for if you want, I understand. Do you want an attorney? And then he provided some ambiguous responses. And the Supreme Court there suppressed. So in that particular situation, just following up and quote-unquote clarifying, they suppressed. How would you distinguish that case, or are you prepared at this point to distinguish that case from this particular case?
I think Smith is pretty different from what happened in this particular case. In Smith, you have an accused who is not... He says, yes, I'm sorry, I'll have the exact words of what he said. He says, oh, yeah, I'd like to do that. There weren't any questions hanging out there. We have to look at this case. The very first thing that Appelli said after he was asked if he wanted an attorney was, do what? Which is a strange response, probably one that law enforcement does not see very often in response to the question of, do you want a lawyer? So that's a difference here from Smith. Also, so there were questions hanging out there that presumably the appellee, or I'm sorry, there were questions hanging out there that presumably appellee could, or I'm sorry, the agent still could have answered. So that differentiates it from Smith. In Smith, the agent in that case just essentially, despite what appellee said, or the appellant in that case said, continued to read Miranda rights until the appellee sort of changed his mind as to what he wanted. That's not what happened here. What happened here is Agent Rea was attempting to clarify, attempting to repeat what that question was, and we know it was a clarification because essentially he added a couple of words on to the end of it. It was like, do you want a counsel or do you want an attorney present at this interview? So it was obviously, if you look at the context of it, an attempt to clarify. It wasn't just plowing ahead with Miranda rights. It's going back to what had happened before. And also, you have to look in Smith. Something that the Supreme Court noted is after the Miranda rights were continued, after the agent continued to go through the Miranda rights, he said something that essentially gave the appellee in that case, or the appellant in that question, the idea, or he implied that the appellee or the appellant had to talk to him. He said something like, either you're going to have to talk now, or you agree, or if you agree to talk, you can stop anytime. It was kind of confusing, and it gave that, and the Supreme Court said, well, it gave the appellee the idea that he had to talk to the agents. That's not at all what happened in this case. The facts are completely different. And if we look at what the agent said, they repeatedly told appellee, you don't have to talk to us. It's your decision whether or not you want counsel. And so for those reasons, I think that Smith is quite different from the facts that we have in this case. Now, I briefly would like to move on and talk about the issue of the reinitiation of conversation, because the military judge in this case erroneously analyzed whether or not appellee had initiated further conversation. She just said appellee did not reinitiate conversation and just left it at that. There was no further analysis in this case, and she should have done that. She should have looked especially at the words by appellee that were when he said, or do we, I'm not for sure how this part goes, so I'm like, do we have to have one? So,
counsel, I know the government in their brief, they argued that that was the quote-unquote natural break, that basically he said okay, he was stopping at that point, and then the appellee reinitiated on that. What evidence do we have of that? I mean, that's really speculation. And you mentioned earlier in your argument that this was a continuous kind of bang-bang talking over each other. So what evidence do we have that that was some natural break on behalf of the agent? Because the agent did testify. Government didn't develop any evidence from the agent about whether or not he felt the accused had invoked, therefore he stopped to allow the accused to then reinitiate. So what evidence do we have that that was a reinitiation and not a continuation of the conversation?
Well, I think when we're talking about what the government has to show, when they have to show initiation, it's the words from Bradshaw are, if the accused initiates further communication, exchanges, or conversations. And so if we just look at the natural order of what happens, appellee says, sure, yes. And then he says, okay, I'm yes. And then after that, the agent says, okay. Now, yes, it was rapid fire, but how can we not consider that a further initiation, if we're just looking at the order of how things occurred, I think that this court can look and evaluate what happened to this video. I mean, after certainly you can't hold the agents responsible for the way they responded or the way appellee responded after the agent said okay. I mean, if the question is after that okay, whether or not the agents asked any more questions or whether or not they initiated further interrogation, certainly they did not. There's just no facts there to say that they initiated further interrogation. It was the appellee who spoke up. He could have stayed silent at that point, and he didn't. We don't know what would happen if he hadn't spoken up or if there had been more time after the okay, but we can't speculate, I don't think, Your Honor. We have to look at the facts as they happened. And the appellee clearly had questions about what was going on. So, and that's why he showed again, as he showed through the entire conversation, that he had questions and confusions about his right to counsel. And so I see that I'm out of time, and I'll reserve, unless there are further questions at this point, I'll reserve the rest for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Chief Judge Mitchell, honorable members of this court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Annie Morgan, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Joy Primoli, we represent the appellee in this matter, Staff Sergeant Charles Buford. Pursuant to an Article 31 rights advisement, Sergeant Buford unambiguously invoked his right to counsel when he responded, sure. There is nothing ambiguous about the word sure. It means yes. In fact, at five different points in the transcript of Sergeant Buford's interrogation, the word sure is recognized by the special agents involved as an affirmative response. And you can find that at pages 51, 104, 117, 152, and 153 of the record. Sure gets Sergeant Buford a tuna sandwich, gets him the ability to write a statement, and the ability to take a polygraph. Sure gets Sergeant Buford everything but an attorney. The question before this court is whether or not the military judge abused her discretion in suppressing Sergeant Buford's oral and written statements to the Air Force Office of Special Investigation. She did not. Military judge's findings of fact are not clearly erroneous, nor are her conclusions of law incorrect. As the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces recently restated in United States v. Henning, the abuse of discretion standard calls for more than a mere difference of opinion. The challenged action must be arbitrary, fanciful, clearly erroneous, or clearly unreasonable. Deference must be given to a military judge's decision because a judge has a wide range of choices and will not be reversed so long as that decision remains within that range. All evidence must be viewed in the light most favorable to Sergeant Buford. Here, the military judge issued a ruling that is fairly supported in the record. As such, her ruling should not be disturbed.
Counsel, you're familiar with the portion of the transcript that seems to state that the accused, prior to Wright's advisement, said, I'm good to talk. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you agree that, let me ask it this way, is there any reasonable dispute as to whether the accused said, I'm good to talk, prior to Wright's advisement?
No, Your Honor.
What do you believe, if anything, this court should do with that piece of information the government believes is very relevant in determining whether or not the ultimate invocation was or was not ambiguous?
Your Honor, I would draw this court to paragraph 27 of the military judge's ruling and specifically pages 27 and 28 of the record. The military judge paid close attention to the facts preceding the Wright's advisement. In her ruling, she discusses the attempt by the agents to minimize the Wright's advisement, referring to it as a formality. She discusses the statement by the agent that at the time prior to the Wright's advisement, it was unclear that Sergeant Buford was suspected of a crime. They said something to the effect of, there's been an allegation that child pornography has been downloaded on your IP address. There might be very good reasons why this happened. And in stating that, it is unclear at that point that Sergeant Buford is in fact suspected of a crime. At that time, as found by the military judge, what is more likely is that Sergeant, or is reasonable, is that Sergeant Buford is being interviewed either in a helping role, as a witness, or perhaps a victim of theft of his internet resources.
How is that relevant to whether the invocation was ambiguous or not?
Well, Your Honor, as far as the government's position that the statement prior to the Wright's advisement created ambiguity because you get a, sure, I'll talk to you, now I won't, the military judge found more persuasive in those facts this idea that Sergeant Buford was not on alert to being a subject. Therefore, when read his rights, when first alerted to the fact he's a subject, the very first words out of his mouth are, sure, that he wants an attorney. So there's no ambiguity there, and the ambiguity created in the beginning prior to being identified as subject is diminishes any persuasiveness that particular statement has.
Counsel, it seems as if you're arguing how this court should view the information of your client's statements before rights advisement. I want to peel that back a little bit. Do you agree with government counsel that in the circumstances where we have a videotape that's attached to the record of trial, that the that essentially there's a videotape exception for 62 appeals, that this court can consider that undisputed evidence?
No, Your Honor. Your Honor, absent a clearly erroneous finding, this court must adopt the facts as found by the military judge. In their brief, the government cites to two cases, Nash and also Hillard, a Fifth Circuit and a Sixth Circuit case, which stand for the proposition that the court can conduct an independent review when there's undisputed evidence. That case is not a military case. We're not talking about an Article 62 review. There's no indication that the standards that we apply. We are bound by U.S. v. Baker, which clearly says that absent a clearly erroneous finding of fact by the military judge, this court is bound by those facts and does not have independent fact-finding authority.
Counsel, let me ask you, if the military judge found as a fact that that was not said, this court could find that was clear, could decide it was either correct, or we could decide that was clearly erroneous. Would you agree?
Yes, Your Honor.
So what do we do when the military judge does not make findings of fact? Does that make their decision, therefore, invulnerable to 62 appeals? Or what's the remedy for the government when a military judge refuses to make findings of fact about certain issues?
Your Honor, pursuant to U.S. v. COSAC, if this court believes that there are legal conclusions that are not adequately vetted in the record, the proper response is a remand for clarification. However, as far as the content of the record, and I believe it was Judge Brown that asked this question, strong evidence that we do not have clearly erroneous findings from this case come from the fact that the senior trial counsel at trial, and I draw this court's attention to pages 80 through 110 of the record. The military judge at that point reads in three rulings, and at page 82, during the first ruling, which has to do with a forensic psychologist, the senior trial counsel actually gets up and objects to a finding of fact. So this court can reasonably rely on the fact the senior trial counsel knows how to object to findings of fact, knows how to ask for proper modification. When you get to the ruling in question here, the military judge on page 110 actually asks, does either party request clarification or request to make any additions to the finding of fact? Neither side did. So to the extent that the senior trial counsel most intimately familiar with this case did not at that time believe either the findings to be erroneous or lacking in a particularly relevant fact, is a strong indication that the military judge had not overlooked something.
I do want to ask a question about standard review. Whether the accused unambiguously invoked his right to counsel, would you agree that it's a mixed question of fact and law?
Yes, Your Honor.
We talked a little bit about the facts, but taking the facts as found by the military judge, and maybe or maybe not, taking facts that where there's no reasonable dispute, and I understand you may have a different take on that, would you agree that it's a question of law whether those facts constitutes an unambiguous waiver?
Yes, Your Honor.
And also in your brief, and I believe it's in the reply brief, you stated that you believe the judge applied an objective standard. What in the record, what in her findings point to an objective view versus a subjective view?
Well, Your Honor, as far as the ruling is concerned, I don't believe there's anything in the ruling that indicates a subjective view. However, as far as the record's concerned and whether or not this is fairly supported in the record.
No, within her findings. Where in there does it appear that she applied a totality? She applied it in other areas. She applied it dealing with whether the waiver itself was knowing and intelligent. But where within the issue of whether it was ambiguous or unambiguous, did she cite towards a objective test?
Your Honor, in the ruling specifically, that she does not use the reasonable law enforcement objective language. Going back to an earlier question that Judge Mitchell had asked the government, Pelley's position is that is not dispositive. And then focusing on what facts she had before her and whether that conclusion is fairly supported in the record, I would draw this court's attention to page, I believe it's 24, of the record. And there's actually a point where the military judge requests from counsel the language of, well, what would sure mean to a law enforcement agent? So the indication is the military judge knows the law, and she's actually prodding counsel on this motion to drive towards an objective standard.
Or is she saying anybody that would have, I mean, she could have said subjectively, that's something that I would have believed also, that everybody believes sure, but if you just say yes or sure to me, that may be very clear, but in a context, which I think this is part of the area that we're looking at, you have to look at the context of the entire interview and all of the facts that occurred. I know we've had some discussion about which facts the judge considered or not, but that seems to be where she didn't do any analysis with regard to all of the facts surrounding the interview until he said, I will talk.
Well, Your Honor, I believe there is, although she may not draw them directly, there is an analysis of what the facts were prior to the Rice advisement and then the statements that Sergeant Buford made post-Rice advisement. And she even accommodates and makes reasonable accommodation that if in any way his first response of sure or is it a yes or no were unclear, that certainly that second sure would have been clear. And again, although she does not use those specific words, I believe the record supports that she is looking at a law enforcement agent. And it's important to note that Special Agent Rea begins testifying on page 13, and when he's testifying, he actually provides, to some extent, a subjective view. And it would have been error for her to adopt that subjective view. Instead, her questions to counsel during the motion imply that she is looking more holistically at what would a reasonable law enforcement agent do, as opposed to even just looking subjectively at what did this law enforcement agent do in this situation.
Counsel, let me ask you one other question. Do you believe a statement by an accused of, I'm good to talk, is somehow inconsistent with an accused requesting counsel?
And I just to be sure I understand your statement, yes, I believe that would be inconsistent on its face.
Okay. So why in this particular case does the I'm good to talk statement, pre-invocation, why does that not create some ambiguity, at least to the extent, so the agent can say, let me make sure I got this right here. You said X, and now you're saying Y. How is this case different?
Well, Your Honor, there's two ways I'd like to answer that question. The first is, it's very necessary to look at what was known to to Sergeant Buford at the time that he made that statement. And at that time, he's not yet, at least it is unclear that he's a subject. And that's based on what the agents had said, that there's this attempt to minimize, hey, there's great reasons why this could have happened. And then moreover, distinguishing this case from the lines of cases where an appellant has gone back and forth of, I want an attorney, I don't want an attorney. If you look at the litany of cases the government has cited, whether it's De La Rosa, Lovely, what you have is post-invocation ambiguity, where you actually have an individual who is, after the Rights advisement, going back and forth. So this, while that statement had occurred post-Rights advisement, would perhaps give rise to some amount of ambiguity because it would appear inconsistent when you view it in the context of this was pre-Rights advisement. This case becomes distinguishable.
So I'm going to ask you a question, and I want your opposing counsel to address this as well. You mentioned that the lack of the military judges saying whether she used an objective standard, right? If I'm going to summarize your position correctly, it's that we presume military judges apply the law, that there's other evidence in the record that she was applying the correct law in her question of counsel, and that therefore, because she didn't use reasonable law enforcement agent in her ruling, but she also didn't say, I'm using a subjective standard, that we should therefore assume that she knows and applies the correct law.
That is correct, Your Honor. Okay. Even if this court were to get past, and again, this isn't a standard about disagreement or what someone would have done differently in the military judge's shoes, but even this, where this court were to get past and find that the conclusion that there had been an invocation, it would still be necessary for this court to look at the second prong. So U.S. v. Edwards covers essentially a two-prong analysis. When you have an appellant who is subject to custodial interrogation, pursuant to a right of advisement, invokes any statements they make after are presumptively inadmissible, absent the government's ability to show that that appellant has reinitiated communication. Initiation is a finding of fact, and that comes from U.S. v. Grower and Edwards v. Arizona. Military judge found as a fact that he did not, Sergeant Buford did not reinitiate, and that fact is fairly supported in the record. Sergeant Buford's statement, or do we? I'm not sure how this part goes. I'm like, so do we have one? That statement was an inquiry that was related to the routine incidents of the custodial interrogation after three times having invoked his right to counsel. Sergeant Buford's statements are not an initiation under Bradshaw, but are instead an attempt to clarify the procedure for obtaining an attorney. And you see that in the military judge's ruling at paragraph 27, where she found that he didn't understand what the agents wanted him to say. And that's very observable in the video. As you watch this dialogue progress in the video, there is the statement, oh, I'd have to wait for another. I'd have to wait for another attorney. You don't have any here. And that's where you see confusion on the part of Sergeant Buford. Not that he wants an attorney, but that he's requested one, and now he's being told, well, there aren't any attorneys around for you to have. After Sergeant Buford makes the statement, I'd have to wait for another, you see a hesitation, and you see a pregnant pause on the video between the agents and Sergeant Buford. And what that drives at is not that these, what you see in that video is demonstrated is that regardless of how many times Sergeant Buford is going to say yes, these agents are going to stare at him and effectively make him second guess, well, am I giving you the right answer? And so put in that situation, any individual is ultimately going to begin to ask questions. That does not constitute initiation as envisioned by Bradshaw. It is not merely a dictionary-driven definition of, well, he started talking again. Of course he started talking again. He's being stared at, being given the indication it's the wrong answer.
All right, counsel, suppose that this court finds that the first unambiguous invocation of counsel is when he says, oh, I'm yes. So that's after the yes, sure, all that. So that's the first unambiguous invocation of counsel. And the agent says, okay. And then the accused starts asking about counsel to include, do we have to have one? Why would that not be a reinitiation if we find that, oh, I'm yes, was the first unambiguous invocation of rights?
Well, Your Honor, it would still be necessary to look at the holistic, everything that happened throughout the course of the rights advisement and the behavior of the agents. And Smith v. Illinois talks about the need to look at nuanced behavior of the agents. What you see in that immediate moment when he's saying, oh, I'm yes, there's a pause from the agents. And taken together with their previous behavior, where there's a question, there's at least a statement, sure, given that it may be ambiguous in this hypothetical, and then a statement, sure, yes. The follow-up question from the agent did not serve a valid purpose. When Special Agent Rea says, well, basically, do you want one here? That's not clarification. That is an attempt by an agent to either confuse Sergeant Buford or to dissuade him. So then when you look forward and find what is a clear, unambiguous invocation in the, oh, I'm yes, it can't be lost on this court that the agents are at least admitting the the body language, the demeanor, to demonstrate to this appellant, this appellee, that he's not making the right choice.
All right. So the question that the accused asks was, do we have to have one? And the response by the agent is, it's up to you. If you want to talk to us right now about this, we're happy to talk. If you prefer to have a lawyer, then we can't really talk right now about the issue. Presumably you're saying there's a problem with that response?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. What should an agent say in this circumstance if the accused says, do we have to have one? Does the agent just ignore or say, I can't answer your question about an attorney until you get an attorney, which seems to be a real circular response?
Your Honor, in this particular situation, there's two problematic phrases. Sergeant Buford has been read his Article 31 rights, and explicit within those Article 31 rights is a right to have an attorney present for that interview. When asking, oh, we've got some here, we have attorneys here, he's told no. That is an untrue statement, and while we certainly don't know if there were attorneys standing outside the door at OSI, and we can suspect there probably weren't, there were attorneys that needed to be made available, and nothing could happen absent those attorneys being made available. What's problematic about Special Agent Wilson's follow-on phrase of, it's up to you, if you want to do this, we can talk, if not, is it further demonstrates that Sergeant Buford is making the wrong decision. Hey, I know we told you you had a right to have an attorney, you told you we had a right to have an attorney here, but you don't really. And so if you keep wanting to go down that attorney line, well, then we can't talk to you. And that has to be taken in context of how this interview is happening. It's 90 minutes away from where Sergeant Buford is actually stationed. When he meets OSI in his first sergeant's office, he's later transported to their detachment, he doesn't have any means of communication or transportation. So the barrier to having this attorney is that much more significant.
It seems like you've moved into perhaps the next issue, which is whether the accused had a full awareness of both the nature of the right being abandoned and the consequence of the decision to abandon it. So I'm not sure how many of those factors would necessarily go into whether or not there was a reinitiation or not, but I am interested in how it would apply to that question of whether it was a knowing and intelligent waiver.
Your Honor, this was not a knowing and intelligent waiver. The Supreme Court in Zerbst and in Brewer have articulated that courts will indulge every reasonable presumption against waiver, and after invocation, a later decision to make a statement should be viewed with skepticism. Sergeant Buford was misled as to his rights, and a very, very basic premise. Going back to what I had previously said about, there is this Article 31 right advisement where he has said, or where the agents have told him, you have a right to have an attorney. You have a right to have an attorney here in this interview. And when he asks the procedure for that, which was a reasonable question, having twice now said, hey, I want one, he is told, no attorneys here. If you want an attorney, you can't continue this investigation. And that's frankly not true. If he wants an attorney, he has a right to have an attorney come into that interrogation room. Those statements render it impossible for this to have been a knowing and voluntary relinquishment of a right. And you contrast that to a case like De La Rosa, where De La Rosa is brought in and where he repeatedly says, I want to talk, he wanted to tell his side of the story about his child's death. He's then provided with a rights advisement form, and you have the agents actually requiring him to tell me in your own words, what does that right mean to you? Do you know what you're doing? There's very little consternation about whether that appellant knew, here was my right, here's what it meant for me to relinquish it, and I can articulate that in my own words. This case is about as different as it can get, in so much as Sergeant Buford is told in one breath, you have this right, and told in the next breath, well, that right's meaningless. So that, on its face, it renders us not knowing and intelligent. To the extent, and this is throughout the government's brief, that they talk about, well, you can conclude that it's knowing and intelligent, or this fact is knowing and intelligent, but the military judge just failed to articulate it in her ruling. She made these leaps of logic, is the phrase that's used throughout the brief. That's not the case. And to the extent that there are facts missing in this record, the government bore the burden at trial to prove by a preponderance of evidence that Sergeant Buford, post-invocation, had knowingly and intelligently waived that right. To the extent that there are facts missing, the trial counsel had the opportunity not only to put that on during the motion by calling witnesses, but also had the opportunity to seek reconsideration on this motion by providing new evidence to the military judge, and so they didn't. So the question becomes not whether or not this court may agree or disagree with the military judge's conclusion, but whether her conclusion was reasonably supported in the record. And here it was.
Counsel, are you asking then that we essentially apply a waiver or forfeiture rule to trial counsel's actions and the military judge's findings of fact or lack of certain findings of fact that are now being argued by appellate government counsel?
Your Honor, it's strong evidence that her findings are not clearly erroneous and fairly supported.
But when we look at whether or not something is clearly erroneous, we look to the record. We have the entire interview that we were able to draw from. Would you agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor. However, to the extent, it's fairly well established that government appeals are disfavored. It's for judicial economy. We want to keep cases moving. We want to get resolution for the parties. And so to the extent that there was a relevant fact that needed to be considered, either by the military judge or by this court, they had that opportunity and declined to do so when the military judge explicitly asked them, am I missing something? They further declined to do that on reconsideration, and you'll see from the time that the military judge issued her ruling on 12 January, approximately 60 hours lapse for the government to file their notice under Article 62. That was time for them to bring this to the attention. To the extent that the government counsel at trial did not feel that this was relevant, it is at least strong indication to this court that it is not a relevant fact, and the military judge did not abuse her discretion by not including it.
I've got a question about standard review, at least as it applies to whether the waiver was knowing and intelligent. I previously asked you about whether it was a question of law, whether the invocation was ambiguous or unambiguous, and you said it was a question of law. Is the judge's finding regarding whether the waiver was knowing and intelligent, is that a question of law, or is that a question of fact? We'd apply clearly erroneous review standard to.
Your Honor, voluntariness has a de novo review. Understanding that there are a sub prong of voluntariness being the knowing and intelligent, it's a mixed question of law and fact.
Thank you.
Finally, the military judge properly applied the law as it applies to custodial interrogations, finding that once an individual is subject to a custodial interrogation, they are required to have a rights advisement. During that rights advisement they invoke, all questioning must cease until an attorney is present. Absent the government either proving that there was a reinitiation or that there has been a break in custody sufficient to allow the appellant to shake off whatever kind of presumptive coercive nature exists within that custodial interrogation. Whether or not someone is subject to custodial interrogation is a finding of fact, although the conclusions drawn therefrom are conclusions of law. And so as a fact, the military judge found that Sergeant Buford was subject to custodial interrogation, and this court should not disturb that fact as it is fairly supported in the record. This court is thereby required to adopt it. Following from that, the military judge properly analyzed Sergeant Buford's invocation and apply to Edwards as it applied both to the invocation and the secondary initiation. From there, the military judge went on to make a determination under Bradshaw of whether, if there was initiation, was it knowing and was it intelligent. The government bore the burden at trial to show the reinitiation or the break in custody, and the break in custody does not appear to be in dispute, at least at this time. However, the military judge was unpersuaded by the government's proposition that there had been initiation, and this court should equally be unpersuaded. The need for Edwards is it's a judicially created prophylactic measure, and it provides added protections against the coercive pressures of continuous custody. And that's really what happened here. When what Edward looked at, what the language of Edwards talks about, is an individual who's cut off from their normal life and companions and thrust into an isolated and unfamiliar police-dominated atmosphere. Sergeant Buford was taken from his base, was subject to this custodial interrogation, and the government failed to carry the water that he either initiated or had a break sufficient to acknowledge those rights. And, Your Honor, I am aware my time is expiring. Absent any further questions, that concludes my presentation.
Thank you.
Your Honor, I want to address as quickly as I can as many points, but I know that my time is somewhat limited. As far as the standard used by the military judge, whether or not it was an objective standard or something else, as far as the ambiguous invocation of rights, I think it's important for this court to look at the record and look at the exchange between the military judge and the trial counsel and defense counsel in this case. The military judge on page 28 of the transcript of the proceeding says, "Do you agree, government counsel, that it is not just what is in the mind of the OSA agent, but it's also what's in the mind of the accused as he is sitting there being interrogated?" That, to me, is evidence that the military judge is using the wrong standard. And I think, as I pointed out earlier in my argument, there are indications in that paragraph 26 that she was indeed using a subjective standard rather than an objective standard. So I would ask the court to please look at that particular part of the record. I disagree with defense appellee's counsel's characterization of De La Rosa. I do believe in De La Rosa that even before the rights advisement, several times the appellee indicated that he wanted to talk to the agents. He did, after rights advisement, during rights advisement, say he wanted to talk to the agents. But I do believe it also occurred before rights advisement, and that was something that the court, CAF and De La Rosa, took into consideration. As far as whether or not initiation is a question of law or question of fact, admittedly, this court has previously said that, yes, it is a question of fact, but I believe if you look at CAF and the way it treated these particular questions in the Hutchins case, it specifically with regard to whether or not police initiated further interrogation, CAF has said that that is a question of law. And I believe that if you apply a similar standard to whether or not appellee, so essentially what you're doing is if you're looking at whether or not appellee initiated, you're looking at that in terms of Innes and Bradshaw. So you're applying these legal Supreme Court standards to facts of this case. And I cited a couple of federal circuit cases where they have said that reinitiation by a suspect is a question of law. And so I ask the court to please look at those citations that we had in our brief, because I do believe it makes sense that the words that were actually said, what was said, that is certainly a question of fact, but whether or not under Bradshaw and Innes in that line of cases, that is an initiation of further communications, exchanges, or conversations, that is a question of law for this court.
Councilman, I know you have a lot to cover, but I just want on that last point, that was a published decision, earlier published decision by this court, that it was a question of fact. Are you asking this court to now overturn that decision?
I am, Your Honor. In light of Hutchins, which I believe is guidance, not completely on point, but very close to on point, I am asking this court to relook at that issue and overturn its prior decision.
And as far, you would agree, though, that CAF has not explicitly overturned that case?
Agreed. Yes, Your Honor. Appellee's counsel attempts to make the argument that just asking about attorney or do I have to have one, that is just a conversation that's a routine incident to custody. Certainly the government disagrees with that, and I can provide a supplemental citation to this court, but I believe this court should look at United States v. Watkins, which is a CMA case from 1992, 34 MJ 344. In that case, the appellee or the accused asked for an attorney, but then started asking the agent whether or not he should get a civilian attorney or a military attorney, and then also how much punishment he was facing. And the CMA in that case found that those statements made were initiation. And we believe that our facts in this case are similar to Watson. And certainly asking about whether or not he has to have an attorney for the interview is very different from asking for a glass of water or asking to the bathroom or other things that would be routine to the incidents of custody. I do want to point out, I think that the evidence in this case shows that the agents here, and I disagree with appellee's counsel in this characterization, the agents here were not attempting to dissuade appellee about invoking his rights. They never said anything that would give anybody that impression. All they were trying to do is clarify what the appellee wanted. And in fact, it's not even necessary according to Davis, if an appellee invokes his right to counsel, or makes an ambiguous invocation, it's not even necessary to ask clarifying questions. Well, the Supreme Court has said that it's certainly good practice to do so. So what the agents were doing in this case was simply a best practice. There was confusion, there are these simultaneous questions hanging out there, and the agents sought to clarify it. That's all they were doing. This is not badgering. This is not the type of behavior that Edwards was intending to disallow.
Davis is a little bit different, right? Because in Davis, there was a prior private waiver of the rights. In this situation, the accused had not yet waived rights. So under MRE, I think 305, isn't it necessary that before further questioning happens, that the agents have to get a clear waiver of the rights to be able to continue with the questioning? I mean, in other words, it's more than just a best practice. It's a MRE 305 requires it.
And I see my time is up. May I answer this question? I do think that for Davis, yes, I mean, it is slightly distinguishable as to the facts. But in general, it is a best practice to follow up. But I mean, even if it wasn't, we're not talking about a best practice here. Or even if it was a requirement that the agents follow up and try to clarify, that's what they did in this case. And certainly there can't be anything that said, when the Supreme Court recommends that that's what you do, it cannot be said that this was a bad police practice. And may I briefly conclude, Your Honor?
Counsel, before you do,
okay.
I'm going to ask you two more questions,
okay.
And I'll see if my colleagues have any additional questions. One, regarding this issue of the subjective intent, even assuming I agree with you, isn't subjective intent the law enforcement agents, isn't that a finding of fact by the trial judge in terms of subjective intent is a finding of fact, and that this court can't find, as we addressed earlier, we can't find facts, and if it's supported in the record, then we have to adopt the trial judge's findings, whether those are the independent results we would have come to or not.
Well, I think that the trial judge did not specifically find that the agent, I don't believe she specifically made a finding that the agents were trying to dissuade him from waiving his right or from invoking his right to counsel. I think all she said was that it's an ambiguous invocation, or it's an unambiguous invocation of the right to counsel. So I don't believe that there was a specific finding of fact, unless I'm misunderstanding your question.
Well, and I'd have to go back and look at the findings by the military judge, but I thought she had one point where she said the agents intended to mislead him or dissuade him from invoking his rights. So isn't that a subjective intent that's a finding of fact by the military judge?
I think what she said, Your Honor, is that he was trying to allay his fears about going to jail or something like that. But to the extent that she made any finding that they were trying to dissuade him from invoking his right to counsel, I certainly think that that is unsupported by the record if you look at the facts and you look at the context of everything that happened. So to the extent that you believe that's a finding, Your Honor, I would ask you to find that that's clearly erroneous and not supported by the record in this case.
And then the next question I want to ask you again was about the military judge's, the absence of her clearly stating she was using an objective standard or clearly stating she was using the incorrect subjective standard. 62 appeal. Government appeals are not favored, and also that generally our presumption is if military judges know and apply the correct law. So how does that factor into our decision?
Well, Your Honor, when there is evidence on the record that she was not applying the correct law, for example, when she uses subjective considerations in her specific paragraph, finding conclusion of law about whether or not the invocation was ambiguous, I don't think she's entitled to that deference when she is has the wrong standard or she's talking about subjective things in there. I just feel there's no indication that she actually did apply the correct law in this particular case. And especially, again, when you look back at the record and on page 28, the fact is, well, she's saying, oh, yes, well, in addition to what's in the mind of the OSI agent, you should also consider what's in the mind of the accused. I think that that's very telling that she was indeed applying the wrong standard in this particular case. And since that's the evidence that's on the record, that she wasn't applying the correct standard, the court should not, in this case, presume that she knew the law and applied it correctly.
No further questions, if you wanted to briefly continue.
Yes, I do, Your Honor. Thank you. In this case, this is not a case of a mere difference of opinion with the military judge. In a suppressing appellee's statements made to AFOSI, the military judge made clearly erroneous and unsupported findings of fact, and she applied the wrong law to the facts of this case. The conduct that is represented by the agents in this case is simply not what Edwards was meant to protect against. The military judge's ruling constitutes an abuse of discretion and should be vacated, and this case returned to trial. Thank you, Your Honors.
Counsel for both sides, I want to thank you for your briefs as well as for your outstanding oral argument. A decision in this case will be rendered in due course. The court is now closed.
All rise.